Every 10 minutes, you would hear people screaming. It was a really bizarre way to make an animated movie.
Tom Bancroft.
Tom has done pretty much all your favorite animated films.
Animated my childhood.
No, I have a twin brother, because if we talk about the past, he's gonna come up. We just did everything together. I remember drawing a squirrel, and I just remember getting a little bit of a crowd around me. This was the first time as an individual I really felt like I wanted to be an artist, and it was like elementary school. I just remember that was the moment where I was like, I like this feeling. It was all those moments that I would sort of have the rest of my life, all rolled up in one. I call this the rise of Glen Keane.
You take it away, please.
Thank you, Cole. Who gets me the most excited about animation? And they're just nobody else. When I look at Glen Keane's drawings,
it's like this reaffirmation of faith in animation.
He was everywhere in the halls of CalArts, and everybody was talking about Glen Keane. And I think when he did the bear in Fox and the Hound, and it was just scribbles all over the page, and a master that is not only humble, but easily inspired. That's what Glen wanted all the time from everybody that worked with him, is to give them a little bit of the inspiration that he got. He would use words like sincerity, believability, more personality. He never talked about the technical stuff. That was the hardest thing about...
Tom Bancroft. I'm always curious about people's start. Always curious about their start, but not just the start in the industry. I'm more curious before that, and I'm wondering, could you pick out a moment early in your life where you're like, okay, I think this is the right path?
You know, it's funny because I'll tell a couple, two maybe, stories really quick, which was, you know, I have a twin brother, and I gotta acknowledge that right off the bat, because if we talk about the past, he's gonna come up. We just did everything together. And you've already had Tony on your podcast. Everybody go back and listen to that episode. I haven't heard it yet, but I heard it's good.
You're such a pro.
But, you know, we grew up drawing together all the time. And so it's what led to us going into being professional artists, of course, because we had a, you know, semi-friendly competition with each other that got in high school not so friendly and very negatively competitive, and then kind of came out of CalArts and tried to kind of through the years work through that, and you know, it got to be a back to a friendly competition, but you know, we would push each other all the time. And so I had somebody built into my life that was not only sort of a teacher for me, but a peer, but also, you know, like, because he'd be reading another art book, I'd be reading another one, I'm studying anatomy while he's studying animation, and we'd sort of like start sharing what we were doing, and now if he's drawing a superhero, I'm critiquing his musculature, and then if I'm drawing sort of cartoony thumbnails of characters or character design, he's kind of critiquing that. And so there was a little bit of that. I mean, we mostly liked everything the same, I will say, but a lot of the same influences and things. But to back up to your question, I remember, and this was an individual memory. Most of my artistic early days are shared memories with Tony, but this was the first time as an individual I really felt like I wanted to be an artist, and it was like elementary school. I was maybe fifth grade or something like that. And I remember drawing a squirrel. I was copying it probably from a coloring book or a photo or something, but I was drawing it freehand. And I just remember getting a little bit of a crowd around me, and some of them were girls, Cole. And that had never happened to me before, that I had a special power that attracted the female race was a life-changing event. Unfortunately, that did not continue to happen in high school. Apparently, the girls didn't care in high school that you could draw, and it actually repelled them in more times than not.
You should have drawn them.
And that's true. And you always make them thinner and prettier. Yeah, I know. But I do remember, like, and I remember my first pressure, too, of, like, I couldn't get the tail right. This still stands out in my mind. I'd done all the head and the body, and people were loving it. And I was live drawing, you know, they were kind of watching, and I was like, well, I had to finish it. I got to the tail and I couldn't understand how to do hair. You know, like when you're really young, hair is really hard because you want to just draw it like it's straw, just lines, and it ends up looking gross and weird and hard and, you know, and it doesn't have volume and all those things. And so it's a tail that had volume and it had soft kind of curl to the hair. And I was just, and it just looked like a scribble lines. And I felt like I'd ruined the whole piece. And I was so embarrassed at the same time. And anyway, I guess that moment kind of summed up what it's like to be an artist. It's the highs and the lows and the pressure and then the struggle internally of like wanting to be and do your best. And it was all those moments that I would sort of have the rest of my life all rolled up in one. And yet I came out of it still going, I want to be an artist. I just remember that was the moment where I was like, I like this feeling. And there was something about the challenge too, that I probably didn't realize that at the time, but I liked the challenge.
I think when people think of Tom Bancroft or Tony Bancroft, you, because you have the same last name, you're twins, it's like connected together. But you, it seems to be that you guys are so happy living that life, sharing a podcast, you know, pursuing the same career, but you guys are always working together on things now, and a lot of touchstones in your life, you know, you're all intertwined and everything. Yeah. But to have a singular moment like that where it's like, no, Tom,
yeah,
want to do this. And I think that's so interesting and so important. I don't have a twin, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's someone out there that looks like me.
Got to put all the good looks into one person with you. Didn't split it in half. Yeah.
One big moment for both of you guys seemed to be when you're both working on Mulan and he's directing, but you're supervising a character, and like how much tension that could have created in your relationship then, because you've got brother hat, boss hat. And yes. I'm wondering, could I get your thought on that as well?
Yeah, it was hard. It was a real struggle, but also a real joy. I mean, I remember those days. And I have a little bit different of a picture of those days than Tony does, even, because I didn't have all the pressures that Tony was going through directing the film. And there was a lot of behind the scenes politics with Tony. And I would imagine he shared some of that on the podcast with you if it came up, because, you know, he was the second director that was added, and, you know, the first director, Barry Cook, you know, was pretty much out there saying he didn't really want another director. He said that out loud. Even when Tony got brought in, you know, he would tell him he didn't feel like he needed him and wanted him there. And, you know, so, and obviously a lot of those fences got mended down the road as they were making the film, but it was a lot of pressure, and Tony feeling like he was sort of second fiddle and things like that. And Disney kind of made it that way. It wasn't just Barry, it was Disney also. And so, you know, you're just helping Barry, that kind of a thing. And that, I think some of those roles switched as it went on. But anyway, my end of that was I was a brand new supervising animator animating what was becoming quickly one of the biggest characters in the movie, Mushu. And once they brought in Eddie Murphy as the voice, because I was looking at, you know, other actors. There was other actors before Eddie, but once he signed on, it was like, you know, now Disney's eyes were on me, and I had my own kind of pressure going on because I was a beginning supervising animator doing what was going to become like the toy of all the merchandising would most likely be, if it wasn't sort of Disney princess type stuff with Mulan, it was going to be Mushu. And so there was a lot banking on Mushu being, and it was Eddie Murphy was the biggest star in the film, was Mushu, voice wise. And so, you know, that had its own pressure, and I almost lost my job. And there's a lot of stories there too of those kind of pressures. But Tony and I, so we went into it with a lot of intrepidation, I think both of us in our own ways. And, but Tony handled it really well. He just treated me like any other animator on the production during the day as we were working. But then he would call me up and he'd go, Tom, can you go to lunch today? I just need a break and I need to get away. Can we just be brothers and go to lunch? And we worked out something on that film that I think helped both of us quite a bit. More Tony than me, I must admit, because I would, once I got past the hump of just proving myself, then I was kind of just, then it was just normal deadlines, but I was having a ball basically. And so, but Tony's struggles kept going. And so he would, we would go to lunch and he would just open up about all the things that he was going through. And we just had to have a pact where it didn't leave that lunch, like it had to stay there. And that when we go back, we're going to be coworkers. We're not going to be brothers really on that production at that point. So we had our bro time, you could say, but it was really sort of a therapy kind of a moment, again, more for Tony, but it was good. It really, I think, helped us. So we did have to wear two different hats and be careful about those two hats. I think, you know, I think that's how we got through that and how it made us actually closer as brothers too.
That's an unbelievable level of maturity to approach a situation like that. And I guess it kind of comes through the love you guys and respect you have for each other to say, okay, let's not have problems and let's listen. And I'm sure it wasn't just smooth sailing. I'm sure there's bumps and things like that.
Sure.
Talking to Dean Dubois and Chris Sanders about it as well before the kind of behind the scenes of Mulan, and he was just like, it was a crazy time animating down in Florida, and they're bumped up against the theme park and you can hear the roller coasters going and they're there trying to animate, and like people forget that that's how things are made.
We had a thing where I think it was every 10 minutes you would hear people screaming because we literally there was a ride called the Tower of Terror, and it was, you know, and it was Twilight Zone themed, and it was like a big, huge hotel, and basically the elevator would go all the way to the top. This was the ride part, and you'd see things all along, ghosts and weird things, and then you'd get to the top, and then the cables get cut, and the whole thing would fall. I think that was the ride part. It was just basically an elevator that dropped really fast. And so like every 10 minutes, and what they would do is when they get to the top, they'd open the doors so you could see out all across Disney World how high you were. Because up till then, you were just in the dark. And then it would open, you'd see it, you'd hear everybody scream. So it's literally, they're screaming out into nature. And our studio was right at the base of it. We were, you know, on another side of a wall. We weren't in the Disney park. We were out in the cast member side of it is what they called it. So there was a wall that separated us. We were kind of by the cast member cafeteria. Mm-hmm. All that was outside of Disney World. And when I say outside, just on this side of a wall, basically, that's all it was. So literally we could look up and see them, you know, screaming their heads off and then falling to their deaths, you know. But we would hear it every 10 minutes, all day long, people screaming. It was a really bizarre way to make an animated movie.
Yeah.
Blood-curdling screams constantly. You just got used to it. You're just like, no, I work in a torture chamber, basically.
Yeah, I work beside an abattoir. It's strange.
It was a strange reality. We did love it, though. Yeah, we would literally just, you know, there's obviously it was an entry and exit, you know, to go in and out of the park, but we did like lunchtime and park walks is what we would call them. Mm. And, you know, you'd eat your lunch and you'd go out with your friends and you just walk around, and it was Florida, so it was hot and you'd be sweaty and all that, but you just kind of just to get out and walk and look at people and kind of like, because everybody comes to Florida and they just wear their ugliest clothes and stuff like that. It's just, it's mostly an American thing. Because they just, you want to be naked, but you can't. So you just wear as little clothes as you can. And so it's a bunch of white people that have been in the winter all day, you know, all year in Virginia mm-hmm. or whatever, now finally taking off almost all their clothes and walking around Florida. And sweating and just miserable and but they're just bleach white and then they're getting burned, so there's like lobsters walking around. Anyway, that's what we would do, is we'd just walk around and like people watch all day. Yeah. Basically, or you know, on our breaks.
I mean, there's very interesting background characters in Mulan, let's be real. There's some,
well, you know, some of those people, that's actually the backstory of Lilo and Stitch. When you see that Lilo likes to kind of take pictures of fat people, it's really an homage to, or just, we'll say tourists, but they are all fat. that's an homage to us at making that movie there in Florida, and wow. Those were the tourists that we were seeing all day.
You're now working on your hand drawn. Is it hand drawn? It's hand drawn, right? It's
a 2D we call feature. It 2D animation. There is puppet, so you know, there is rigs, but there's also, it's hybrid. There's also hand
hybrid,
drawn.
Hybrid, yeah. Well, tell us a bit more about it. What can you tell me about it?
Yeah, well, it's called The Light of the World, and it's the movie, I like to say, it's the movie I always wanted to make but never knew I wanted to make it. It's crazy to call it sort of what I'm going to, right now, it feels like the movie that I'm going to care the most about in my career, even though I worked on Lion King and Beauty and the Beast and Mulan and all these movies. And it's because it has my faith in it, because it is a Christian film. It's the story of Christ, basically, but told through the eyes of young John, the apostle. Like it's sort of bringing the band together of all the apostles and them searching, John and Andrew and Peter, especially at the beginning, searching for the Messiah. And so you don't have to really know the Bible or anything to, I think, be interested in this story the way we're telling it, because Jesus isn't the star, it's John. We're seeing it through the eyes of a kid that basically, I liken it to sort of our, in the 90s at Disney, how would Disney in the 90s would have made this movie? They would have done it through the eyes of a you know, coming of age child. So he's like about 13, 14 years old. And he's trying to do something to save his family. So he does go on this trek, you could say. But in his case, it's not some diamond or golden scepter or magical lamp that he's searching for. It's a Messiah that is, they've been told for generations that will save their people. And when he finds him, he finds, yes, this is the guy that's going to save our people, but it's not the way we think he's going to save us. They think he's going to basically slaughter all the Romans.
Be like a superhero. Right.
And then the fact that this is all a true story, and I think historically that's been proven, that the Romans did, you know, obviously they were, you know, taking taxes from the Jews. They were overseeing, you know, overseeing is a nice way of putting it, the Jews. You know, all of that is true, and all of these people, you know, can be proven that they existed too. So we're doing a lot of historical research and things like that, but then at the same time, we're kind of taking that story and we're adapting it, because you have to do that when it really took over years. You know, we're condensing some time and trying to tell this story, so it probably feels more like it's a year when it was really 3 to 5. So it's, you know, when I say it's kind of the movie that I never knew I wanted to make. Also, I brought in Tony. So I'm a co-director on it with John Schaefer, the other director who we had worked together on in a project, like a TV series for CBN years ago. And it was a faith-based kind of a TV series. Anyway, so he was a good friend and he called me up and he said, you know, basically, I got hired to make a 2D animated feature film on the life of Jesus. Do you want to join me and co-direct this with me? Because I don't know 2D animation. John had come from CG animation world. And I was like, yes. I didn't know I did, but yes, I do want to do that. And we got a great art team. The style of it is really cool. It's kind of inspired by a lot of the European art, but especially like Cartoon Saloon, kind of a influence, I will say. And we've hired a lot of the same people. A lot of our freelancers that are doing backgrounds and character design worked on a lot of the, you know, the Secret of Kells or a little bit later kind
of
movies.
So exciting, isn't it? That is so exciting.
So it has that kind of a look. We're just really excited about it because you just haven't seen anything like this. I think it's a brand new take on a subject that you would normally hear pitched to you and go, pass. But and I'm saying that as a Christian too. I would say that, you know, there's not a lot of movies out there that are, you know, faith-based that you actually want to watch. So,
well, that's true.
Where I was leading was Tony. We hired in Tony, so he's now the animation director. So he's working with, and we're working with the studio Lighthouse Studios there in Ireland. That's our connection, you and I, Cole. And so we were just there visiting, and that's where we got to do a live podcast that you helped really put together for us. And thank you.
You're very welcome.
That's full story of, you know, where we are. We're just now entering production on that film. We got another year and almost a half before it'll release the summer of 2025 at this rate, we're hoping. And praying.
And praying.
Honestly.
I mean, yeah. You might as well pull it in. When I think about movies that have incredible stories, probably one of my favorite animated films is The Prince of Egypt, right? Mm-hmm. Very, very, very biblically referenced story, very heavy. But, you know, it's so well told, it's so human in its telling that I think people sometimes forget that it's based on kind of a religious text, and there's all this kind of mm-hmm. truth and spirituality that's all mixed in there. But realistically, you know, most stories aren't like that anyways. You take any story that you're talking, and it's a character learning about themselves, and that's an internal journey, which is a spiritual one, you know. So I'm really excited to see what you guys do with this, and I'm more excited now that I know understand the art direction of it. So
oh yeah, if I showed you images of our concept art and things like that, you would get excited about it. And it honestly, we've got some top tier, including my brother, of course, but top tier people. And I signed on for the same reason. John showed me the concept art and I was like, oh, you're going to do it like that? I'm in. And every other Disney person or pro that we showed to get storyboard art, you know, artists and, you know, anybody to sign on, we would show them the artwork and they would go, oh, that's pro level. That's not what I expected. And so it turns heads, and I'm just praying we get as much of that on the screen as possible.
Yeah, you know? I mean, this is the year now to find out, right? Speaking of getting hearts onto screens, I would love for you to introduce what you've picked as your topic of discussion.
It is Glenn Keane, and I don't want to take over this podcast at this point, but I have a ton of stories. And I call it, I already gave it a title because I'm used to being a podcaster. I call this The Rise of Glenn Keane. Because it's
specifically... You take it away, please.
Thank you, Cole. I have notes and everything. So because when we talked about this and you said, who do you want to talk about? It's usually a movie or whatever. And I know Tony did an animator. He did Freddie Moore. I kind of was like, yeah, I'd have to rewatch a movie to really have analyzed it to feel like I could talk, you know, about it. But when I heard Tony had done an animator with Freddie Moore, I thought, you know, I'm going to talk about Glenn Keane, because I started thinking about it in my head. It was like, well, who, if it was a person, like who gets me the most excited about animation? And they're just nobody else. And that's not fair. I do want to give a caveat. I was trained by Mark Henn, and he's considered one of the top five people at Disney, especially in the 90s and 2000s when I was there. He was my mentor, and I worked with him closely. So I have some guilt saying Glenn Keane instead of Mark Henn. And I learned a ton from Mark Henn. But what I did on a technical side, all my animation, how I animate, it's all via Mark Henn. I'm definitely a Mark Henn Jr. in that way. But when I look at Glenn Keane's drawings, and anybody that has seen him knows what I'm talking about, and him as a person, I worked with him once on Pocahontas. He was my supervising animator. I animated Pocahontas. I was on his team. And so that was my touch point where I went, oh, this is a whole nother level. And no offense to Mark Henn at all. I don't mean it that way. But I mean, like, this is why everybody respects Glenn Keane. I thought it was just the drawings. And then meeting the man and working with him, I realized, oh, no, it's all those other rumors you hear about how nice he is and how he lifts people up and how he helps people get promoted. And anybody that has worked with him generally rises in the ladder because of Glenn. And I mean the business ladder at Disney. They become supervisors and leads and things like that. And it's because... one, he doesn't just pick anybody. He's pretty selective. So if you get on his list of being a part of one of his teams, it's not by accident. He considers those people profoundly. And he gets kind of first choice, I must admit, on every film of who he wants on his team. And so it's not only an honor, it's like being nominated for Academy Award to be on his team. But then, you know, you're going to learn a lot and you're just going to be inspired and learn how to be not only a leader, but also a better animator and just think about. So anyway, I have a lot to say about Glenn, even though I know Mark better and his processes. I want to talk about Glenn Keane. I just, there's nobody that gets me more excited.
Even just before we started talking, I was like, no, I know you guys have had Glenn on multiple times in your podcast, several times. And every time you do, it's like this reaffirmation of, I don't know what else, faith in animation, right? It's just this, he's just so thoughtful and boisterous and open and honest. And the level of artistry that just exudes out of this man, this kind of, he's a quote where he says, you know, if you hold a pencil in your hand, there's a line that connects from there directly to your heart, you know, and you guys always say animate from the heart as part of your thing. I know that's a quote you have from one of your images on
from Glenn. Yeah, he wrote it on a drawing.
But please take it away, Glenn Keane.
Okay, so now going back, Tony and I were young pups and we were going to CalArts, and it's a long story how we got there, but really we didn't know we were going to be animators. This was 1987, 88, somewhere in there. And this was before really Disney Animation had its sort of rebirth. They were making, I think Disney was making Oliver and Company around that time. And so again, when that came out, by the way, Oliver and Company was their biggest hit almost ever. Nobody knows this, but I think it made $80 million or something like that. And they were jumping for joy at Disney. They had never made that much money. So that really, literally, to Disney on their paper, on the paperwork, that's probably where the second renaissance happened, was actually Oliver and Company. And that was pre Who Framed Roger Rabbit. A lot of people think it's Who Framed Roger Rabbit that gave the rebirth and all that, but they would probably point to like, no, look how much money we made on Oliver and Company, which is like nothing compared to what they make nowadays, of course. Well, used to make. Anyway, that's another story. So anyway, long story short is we were at CalArts and we were just discovering this, hearing rumors about who's this Glenn Keane guy, right? But he was everywhere in the halls of CalArts, not physically, but on everybody's tongue. Everybody was talking about Glenn Keane. And so very quickly, we started seeing drawings. Almost all the wannabe animators at CalArts, the students, had drawings of Glenn's by their desk, right? And that's to this day, that still happens. But it was like Ratigan, right? From Great Mouse Detective. And it was maybe Georgette from Oliver and Company. He hadn't done his true masterworks yet. But that was the Glenn that I want to kind of talk about, is what I call early, the rise of Glenn Keane. And so historically, what I started finding out about was that Glenn had been there for years. He's second generation. I kind of consider myself third generation because I was trained by a lot of the second generation. So if you had the nine old men, Glenn and Marquen, my mentors, were both trained by the nine old men. They came in as the sort of the replacements unofficially for the nine old men. And John Musker, all the people about that age, even the Brad Bird and even in a way, what's his name? Tim Burton, although he got fired. That was that generation of people that came in right as those guys were still there. Some of them had left. Milt had left a little bit earlier. But Frank and Ollie and Eric Larson, they were all still there and training the next generation. Oh, Don Bluth, of course, was a big part of that. He was sort of almost in between. He was older than a lot of those young guys. And so he was like sort of a almost like a junior nine old man already. And so Glenn enters that, and he really wasn't the Glenn Keane we all know about, obviously. He was just kind of come into Disney. But I do think he had a lot of energy and things like that, and all of that we still know and love about Glenn was there, that but probably even more so of like, he was probably a jerk about it. He was just so on fire, you know, about like, we can do anything and all that. And that's kind of where the rat's nest and the Brad Bird, and they would kind of, the young guys didn't necessarily get along with the old guys. They I think they looked at them as legends, but a lot of those guys, and we're not, I'm not necessarily saying Frank and Ollie, but I am saying, like, there was a lot of entrenched older people that had been there for many years. They didn't like this new generation of people coming in, the Glens, the John and Ron Musker, John Musker and Ron Clements and Brad Bird and all those people. And so they kind of, you know, kind of sanctioned them off in like a little area where they were kind of on their own. And yeah, they would train them and stuff, but you're working for me, you know, kid, you're under me. And so, like, there came a point where they wanted to start, you know, being supervisors and leads, but the old guys were still there and they're not going to let that happen and all that. So there was a lot of conflict that a lot of people don't know about in those early days at Disney's. And I'm talking about like late 70s, early 80s ish. So along comes a movie called The Fox and the Hound. And Glenn had been kind of rising in the ranks. He'd worked on the original Rescuers. By the way, Mark Ken, I got to tell this side story. Mark Ken has Glenn's animation from when he was a trainee and he was working under Frank Thomas. And it's just this little, and I flipped it before. He has all the drawings because Glenn just threw it away. Because back then they would just throw away their roughs. Yeah. They don't keep them. And so Mark had been sort of a younger guy that had just, maybe he was still an intern, I'm not sure. But he found that stack and he grabbed it and he still has it to this day. And what it is it was one of Glenn's first scenes on The Rescuers where it's Bernard just sweeping, you know, as he's like this guy overhearing these, you know, what's happening with the mouse spy group. I can't remember what they're called. And so it's just literally like him kind of sweeping around and it looks like anybody could have done it. It's not like, and he's tiny. Bernard is tiny on the page. He's only like an inch tall. And Mark would tell me like this story is like, Frank made him redo that like 8 or 10 times because it just didn't feel lively enough or whatever. And like nowadays we would have been like, it's moving, it's grooving, approved. You know, we wouldn't be like, do it 10 times. But that was how they would train these guys. They'd make them do it over and over. Now, like, think about how you would actually do that. And, you know, I want to feel that anticipation here. And then, so, you know, like, they would really grill them. And so, anyway, Mark has that early Bernard animation of him just sweeping. And it was really neat for me as an early animator to flip that and go, okay, even the greats start right here, you know? But anyway, soon comes like Pete's Dragon and Glenn starts getting some better and better animation. He did some key stuff there, but really it was The Fox and the Hound. So like, this is pre-me. I would hear about it later on as a student at CalArts, as other people would come in from Disney or whatever and be guest speakers. They would talk about that profound moment when Glenn animated the bear. It's this bear attack in The Fox and the Hound. And so if you watch that now, I've seen the rough animation of this. It's amazing, the drawings. He became a fine artist for the first time, I think. He was trying to try and be like Frank and Ollie. And I think when he did the bear in Fox and the Hound, it was probably one of his earliest successes where he just did what he does. And it was just scribbles all over the page. And I've seen interviews where he talks about it. He's like, I wanted this bear to be like, and he talks like he is, like he just gets into it when he talks about it. I love Glenn that way. When he's talking about it, he's like, I felt like the bear just had to be like, just gruesome. And I would read about true attacks of bear attacks on real people. And it would talk about how they ripped his face off and just the power that they had. So I just had to draw it bigger. And I just drew it bigger and bigger. Pretty soon it's just bear all over the page. Like, I've seen that interview, they used to play it at Walt Disney World, where Glenn is talking about animating the bear in Fox and the Hound, and they show the pencil test, and it's just like sketchy, rough, but has all this energy to it. And if you look at the movie now, when they cleaned it up, and this was back when they still had ink and paint, I think. Yeah, no, they were doing xerography. So, but anyway, when they cleaned it up and then added extra ink on it and stuff, they took out all that magic and juice that he had in it. It was one of his early, I think, kind of profound feelings of like, oh, it lost all that energy. And I've heard this story from animators, older animators through the years, of like, you should have seen what that used to look like, but what it's in the movie is not at all what it looked like. And I get why that happened. I mean, you know, the Klimt people had to do, you couldn't have inked and painted what Glenn animated. And so it was just so all over the place, but had such raw energy. They tried, but, you know, they lost a lot of that. And so what's in the movie is not near what Glenn had animated, but the animators put him on a pedestal because of that. And that was the rise of Glenn. Was, I think, I'm going to say it out loud, I think it was Fox and the Hound that really lit that fire. So then comes along Oliver and Company, and now this is what I was influenced by, was I saw Ratigan. He did the Ratigan character, and it was that I was coming out of being a cartoonist. Tony and I did comic strips in high school, and so I see his Ratigan, and I'm like, that's the epitome of Disney animation to me at that time, because he had subtle gestures he would do and things like that. And it was, what's his name, Price, that did the voice. Now I can't remember. Vincent Price. Vincent Price had done the voice. So he's this old school actor, you know, kind of over the top, but really good at, you know, doing like this villainous kind of a voice. And Glenn does all this cartoony stuff. He'll do really broad movements, and then he'd kind of get him really subtle and do these little tilts of the head and things like that. And I was like, that's what I want to do. Like, that's the perfect character to me. Is like, and on top of that, I saw all the rough drawings, and they were just amazing. And then I backstepped and saw what he had done just before that, which was A Christmas Carol. I didn't see it when it came out, I don't think, but I would have been in high school or somewhere. Because I think it was A Christmas Carol, Fox and the Hound, Christmas Carol, then Great Mouse Detective, and then Oliver and Company. So I'm really talking about that era, which is early 80s, we'll just say. And so when The Christmas Carol came out, which was probably, yeah, around 80-ish, as I'm guessing, is... he did the giant, you know, Mickey and the Beanstalk, that big dopey giant that's in that. They brought him back as, you know, what was it? The Christmas Present, the ghost of Christmas Present. And that animation, to me, was probably one of the ones, even before Ratigan, that I locked into and went, if I could just animate a character like that the rest of my life, I'd be thrilled. Because if you watch that... And I'm sure Glenn looks at it and goes, oh, I'd never do it like that. Yeah, like he's probably destroyed by it. But yeah. I had seen the drawings, I'd seen cells from it, and because they all were kind of being released around that time, a few years after it had come out. And man, that giant, go back and look at it, everybody that's listening right now, just look up Mickey's Christmas Carol, Ghost of Christmas Present, or just the giant or whatever. I found a nice little YouTube on it, where it's just that sequence, and it's just really fun. It's pure, because Glenn later on in his career, he could draw so well, and they got more and more serious about the movies they were making, to the point where we're doing Pocahontas, where it's like a real person, and we're rotoscoping things and stuff like that. And it just, like, to me, that, I mean, obviously Glenn did amazingly beautiful drawings of Pocahontas later on. But it was sort of like Milk Call, like because Glenn was so good and so talented at drawing, they would put him on the lead characters. And as the studio wanted to get more and more Academy Awards, like that's what Jeffrey was really pushing for, was they just got more and more serious in the kind of movies we were making. And so to me, the last kind of cartoony one we did was Aladdin. And then from there, it got kind of more and more real. Like Aladdin had a cartooniness to it that was just, to me, the perfect amount of Disney subtlety, but also some really fun cartooniness that why you want to watch a cartoon, honestly. And that's not just the genie, that's even Aladdin, the main character that Glenn did. He's still got a cartooniness to him, just enough that you want to kind of just look at him. He's fun to look at. He's a little more active.
Great curves on all those characters as well. There's a great flow on everyone in Aladdin. You know, it's very circular.
It is.
as you, and you're right, it does start to kind of push in toward realism. I'd always say Hercules to me was still like, there's like a great touch of design that comes back into that. But I'm so curious about that era of animation you're talking about, the kind of early 80s, well, let's just say the 80s. A lot of people kind of skip over that when they talk about Disney nowadays.
They right? do.
But yeah, they just tend to skip over it. Even I've got all Disney DVDs and I look at everything longingly, but my eyes just kind of zip past that era. But it's so good to hear talking about that, that stage. And I think, you know, for you to find the love and appreciation, because that's your time when you came up and you found these people who inspired you, right? And like we're talking about Glenn Keane. Unbelievable, the master of appeal. I just, you know, I can't describe it. You just have to look at his work, really, to like understand what's going on. What I find is with Glenn, you know, and you guys, I know you guys have talked about your fate and everything before, but like there's something about him that's so deeply connected to humanity. Mm-hmm. and you know, his animation to me always shows this idea of what is animation if not a study and celebration of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's really deep into that, and the characters that he draws, the eyes that he's, you know, the love and everything he's able to get out of the eye. And what people would think of now as the Disney aesthetic is essentially the female characters he's designed, like the Ariel or Rapunzel and people like that. And, you know, the depths of this man's influence is unbelievable when it comes
to that. Oh, I know. Because everybody talks about him as an animator, but what they don't really realize is he was a character designer too. He designed a lot of those, at very least, the final version of all those lead characters that he animated. And so he's an excellent character designer also. And just really, and now I think he is somebody, I call him like, I teach character design. I wrote a book on character design. And so, you know, I look at character design with a very, you know, a little bit more specific, I guess, ways, which
analytical.
I've analyzed it. And so I feel like there's two different character designers. There's like the blue sky artists that just churn out tons of drawings and they all look really varied and they're just tons of different shape and forms and all that and neat ideas. And they're just sort of all in the ideas. They can't do a turn sheet or an orthographic if they wanted to, but they're awesome at that, just coming up with variations. And then there's like the character refiner who is somebody that can now take some of what that blue sky person did, and multiple blue sky people, because that's how Disney would do it. They'd hire like 6 or 8 different character designers, all doing different styles of the same characters, and then give it to the supervising animator and go, we like this on this one, we like this on this style, we like this head over here, this body over here, you know. And then the supervising animator, and I found this with Mushu, that's what I did too, would then have to be the funnel to come up with the final design. And oftentimes it wasn't like, you would never go back and go, oh yeah, I could see where that all came from, because they're all such different varied things. But they were just good at going, okay, I know how to take all these really neat broad ideas and funnel it together and create a character that has a presence, that has all the things that the story needs. And Glenn was so good at that. He got inspired so easily. And I think that's really the heart of being a great artist, is you get inspired easily. And Glenn gets inspired easily. He sees not only from life, but drawings. And like, he's talked about having people underneath him that inspired him. Like, mm-hmm. you don't hear that from a lot of master artists, where they're like, he was talking about when he was at Netflix, I met with him and actually filmed him for my documentary, Pencils versus Pixels.
Yes, yes, yes.
And he was telling a story about, I think it was Brittany Myers. Brittany Myers was on his team. She was like just out of, I don't even know if she'd gone, I think she was just out of school or was still in school. And he brought her in as a character designer just based on seeing her Instagram stuff. And it was her or somebody else, but he was seeing like their figure drawings. I think it was somebody else. It wasn't Brittany, I don't think, but saw some, I'm cross-pollinating two different stories. But anyway, it was somebody on the team, and he just loved their figure drawings and would talk about how their figure drawings are way better than his. And he just emulated. They'd have lunches where they'd just talk about, look through his figure drawings. But he said the same kind of thing with Brittany, with her character designs too. It's like, she comes up with things I would never come up with. She did a drawing of Ariel and she posted it on Instagram. This is how she got the job. Glenn Keane saw this Ariel fan art that she did, and he was like, oh, I wish I would have done some of what you did in this drawing in the movie. Like, here's the master that did the thing that inspired her, and he's going, I wish I would have, you did some things here that I wish I would have done. And he hired her because of that fan art. She's told that story, I think it was on our podcast, actually.
Shout out.
Go listen.
Yeah. Go listen.
But like, that's to me like a master that is not only humble, but easily inspired. He sees things and he's being humble, but I think it's true humility. I'm not saying it's fake, but I think he probably in his mind can acknowledge, well, I would have done this different, this different, this different, like a list of 10 different things, but he's seeing, but that one thing there, I've never tried that before. And that gets me excited. And that's that heart of always wanting to grow, always wanting to be better.
Curiosity, right? You know,
yes.
Curiosity is really the killer of the ego. And if you're open and curious, you know, I was raised in a very judgmental household. So it took me a long time to like find a spark of curiosity. And that's what I tried to do with this podcast is this is my journey of curiosity to learn from brilliant minds about what makes them curious as well. And it's just like, you can't go wrong with curiosity. This phrase, curiosity killed a cat, I understand it to a degree, because that's, you're really looking for gossip there. But true curiosity, it's like exactly what you said. It's a spark, right? It's a spark of, there it is. I'm looking for that. And I want to know so much about it. And humility shines through that. And I love that.
I think inspired curiosity is a better way of putting it, because you're right. Curiosity, just the general term, there's idiotic curiosity where you walk down a dark alley at night and you know there's nothing that you should be doing down there. Nothing good is in that alley. But you go anyway because you're like, oh, I can, you know, it's sort of cocky, stupid curiosity. Okay. But then there's inspired curiosity where you're, and I think it's really what you want the outcome to be, whether you know it or not, is you want that outcome to be learning and wisdom. And that's Glenn, is that he's always seeking out wisdom. And how can you go wrong with that kind of curiosity?
Yeah.
I got to end, because we're talking about a little bit the inspiration of Glenn. I got to end with a story, okay? So after being a fan of Glenn's, I finally got that opportunity on Pocahontas to work with him directly. And so even though I was in the Florida animation studio and he was in California, they needed somebody to animate Pocahontas in Florida. And a couple of us got that opportunity. But he picked me first, which was really awesome. He just said, okay. And I had to submit a portfolio. It's a whole story. Like, that never happened before. But all of his team, he wanted to see a portfolio of figure drawings to get on his team. And so I passed. I got on there. That was awesome. And fast forward, I'd gotten my first few scenes. And he was like, we're going to have a big How to Draw Pocahontas talk. And you need to fly out. And so a couple of us that were animating Pocahontas in the Florida studio, we flew out so we could be with the team, and it was going to be a big kickoff and get us all excited. And I would start doing thumbnails for this first batch of scenes that he gave me. So it was a good week that I was going to be out there. Well, unfortunately, I have a twin brother that worked at that studio. And he has a bunch of friends, Nick Riordari and Mike Suri and these other animators that I liked also. And so we hung out a lot. We were taking kind of long lunches. I was just being stupid. And rather than really like getting entrenched, I just remember I have guilt. And I did work. It's not like I didn't work. But there was a little vacation side to it in my head, I think. And so I was young and I probably was not putting that kind of effort in. But I remember that I have this bitter and sweet memory from that moment, which was, I'd gone to a lunch, and I think it was like a 2-hour lunch, and And I knew we weren't going to have a meeting till a little bit later, so I just took an extra long lunch. Anyway, I come back, but I had stuff I was supposed to be doing. And I come back, and there on my desk, on the office they'd given me for the week, on my animation desk was a piece of paper with a letter from Glenn and a pencil. And he wrote this totally inspired. He said, "Tom, I still have this letter. Tom, I stopped by to say hi and get and talk to you a little bit about the character and your scenes. I'll come back later." He wasn't giving me a hard time about it. But I just wanted to leave you with this pencil. This is the kind of pencil I'm using. And it was one of these thick, nubby, at the time it was like a Drowning pencil that he was using, this is a lot of the animators are using this pencil to draw Pocahontas and stuff. And so I'm giving it to you. And he said, with this pencil, you will create some of the most sincere and believable animation of your career. And I'm so excited to see what you do with it. And that little bit of inspiration both crushed me because I felt like I'd already let him down by being late. And then at the same time inspired me. I still have the pencil. I used it a little bit, but I kept it aside a little bit and got another one. But because I wanted that note and that pencil, but that was Glenn. He meant that. He wanted to say all those things in person and he had to write it down, but having it written down actually in the long run means more to me that I still have those words written. But that's what Glenn wanted all the time from everybody that worked with him, is to give them a little bit of the inspiration that he got from Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston and things like that about believability and sincerity. Like when he directed your animation, he never talked about the technical stuff. That was the hardest thing about working with Glenn. It was so heartfelt and from the heart. He would use words like sincerity, believability, more personality. It wasn't like, oh, here, retime this, or oh, you need a couple in-betweens here. We never get into the technical side of animating. He was so far beyond that, honestly, that he didn't have to think about the technical side anymore. And he wouldn't talk about arcs and things like that, very rarely. Mostly he was talking about the performance and the feeling of the character and what they were thinking. And that was the way he was taught. He would hear words like sincerity and things like that from the nine old men because they were at that level too, where they weren't talking about, I think Eric Larson did that when they trained him, but mostly those other guys, they would talk about what is the character thinking and feeling. And so he was the first animator that I'd worked with where that was 90% of what he talked about. And it would be hard. You'd go back to your desk and like, how do I put more sincerity into this? I don't know how to actually do, but he would try to inspire you to find and that is what made us all grow. That generation that worked with Glenn, especially, we grew not from the technical side of it, but we grew from the thought process side of it, which is way more important. And that doesn't get taught at schools today, by the way, is nobody talks about the performance side and the thought process behind being an animator. But he's a fine artist disguised as an animator. He's like, Glenn is like Michelangelo. If he was here today, he'd be a Disney animator because Michael and Da Vinci, especially, like they were so intrinsically interested in the human body and movement and things like that. And they only had one way to communicate it. It was, two sculptures and paintings. But if they had 2D animation, oh my gosh, they would have jumped into that and mastered it. And basically, that's what Glenn is. I honestly think he's a modern master because he thinks about fine art. To him, animation is the ultimate art. And I agree with him.
I agree with him too. I think that, that attitude has definitely been passed on to your guys' work 100%. Mm-hmm. There is an emotion and a feeling that I feel when I see your drawings. I've got one hanging here that you guys gave me. Mm. And I don't think about the technical aspect of the pencil. I see feeling coming through. And... Mm. I think that's an amazing thing to pass on, to recognize that. And now you guys are doing that. So thank you so much. You know, your legacy is wonderful and ongoing. And I really am so humbled to get to talk to you and talk about what is your passion. So thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Cole. I really, really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.